Bob. Jim Bob. Jim Bob, Jim Bob, Jim Bob, Jim Bob. Although neither of the executioners had spoken with a southern accent, I sounded to myself as though I must be trying to track down some good old boy with a red neck and a tattoo with a Confederate flag somewhere on his body. Good old Jim Bob, with a juicy wad of chewing tobacco tucked up in his cheek, and Merle Haggard playing on the radio of his pickup, while he drove around with a loaded rifle, looking for a possum to shoot so that he could bring it home to the little woman and have her make her mighty fine stew that she served over buttered grits with collard greens on the side. Psychic magnetism doesn't work if I'm distracted, and I was so distracted that the word distracted wasn't strong enough to describe my state of mind. Spinning Jim and Bob into a fantasized good old boy wasn't the only thing that kept me from focusing my paranormal gift for tracking people. I kept thinking about my dream, too, chewing it over like Jim Bob with his chaw. My mind also kept bouncing back to Ficus Nitida versus Indian Laurel, which had nothing to do with this crisis except that the chief happened to ask me about it. When it wasn't Ficus Nitida, it was the plump woman with the masses of curly auburn hair giving me the admission ticket and assuring me that I would be a big winner at 11:45 if I remained on the midway. And when the plump cashier stayed out of my head for a minute, her place was taken by bare-suited Lou and mega-tattooed Ollie. Or by Gypsy Mummy spitting up blank cards. Or by the coyote that had stood on the street and stared boldly at me as I climbed onto the big dog bike early that morning, after leaving the abandoned mall to the bats and carnivorous beetles that now called it home. I also began to feel I was being tailed. I couldn't stop glancing in the rearview mirror. Three times when a vehicle behind me struck me as suspicious, I turned at the first intersection, but none of them followed me. Only 15 minutes after terminating the phone call with Wyatt Porter, I realized that I was cruising the state route to Malo Suerte Lake, doing 80 miles per hour, 20 over the limit. Considering that my psychic magnetism currently functioned even less well than a $10 billion government computer system, I had no expectation of finding Bob and Jim at the dam. Either I was hurtling toward Malo Suerte out of desperation, hoping for a new lead now that those two men without faces and surnames had proved elusive, or my usually reliable intuition had kicked in once more. Suddenly I remembered that although Jim and Bob were without faces, I had two, the one I was born with and the one Connie had given me at the carnival. The cops guarding the dam would be edgy already, on the lookout for armed-to-the-teeth cultists with over a ton of C4. If I showed up painted like the most recent theatrical psychopath to terrorize Gotham City, a tragic mistake might be made. This was a world, after all, of tragic mistakes. I didn't want to waste time driving back across town to the farther outskirts where the Bullocks maintained the safe house, just to scrub off my mask. If I stopped at a service station to use their facilities, I'd have to ask for the key, at which point there would probably be some tedious back and forth about my painted face, which would seem as bizarre outside the carnival as it had seemed ordinary on the midway. Instead of going directly to the dam, I drove to the park on the North Shore, where I'd had breakfast that morning with Ozzie Boone and Chief Porter. The park was closed for the night. I left the Explorer on the shoulder of the highway, scaled the gate, and walked about 30 yards through darkness to the buff brick building that housed the public restrooms. Two security lights, two doors, both were locked. Fortunately, the desert-style landscaping around the premises offered cacti and succulents and mostly decorative rocks. Because Merivia County wasn't so prosperous that it could afford night patrols of gated parks, I picked up two rocks the size of oranges. Hesitated, because of a lifelong tendency toward good citizenship, and then pitched the first one through a window. After using the second rock to break out the jagged shards that remained around the edges of the frame, I boosted myself over the sill and into the building. I'd never before broken into a bathroom. It wasn't one of those firsts that you include on a resume. Using the little flashlight that hadn't been left on the dresser in the safe house, glass snapping and crunching underfoot, I went to the paper towel dispenser and yanked several sheets from it. At the middle sink in a bank of five, I regarded myself in the mirror and confirmed the wisdom of a thorough face-washing. When not in the context of the carnival, the harlequin mask in the black and white diamond pattern looked sinister in the extreme. For the task at hand, the flashlight wasn't as bright as I would have liked, but both common sense and paranoia argued against switching on the overhead fluorescent panels. When finished, I leaned close to the mirror. As far as I could tell, I'd scrubbed off all the paint. Yet something was wrong with my face. I'd never had a high opinion of my looks. I'd always felt that I was ordinary, which was all right, because a girl as beautiful as Stormy Llewellyn had still found reasons to love me. But now something about my face unsettled me, and the longer I looked at myself, the more disturbed I became. I told myself that the quality of the light distorted my reflection, because no matter how I angled the beam of the flashlight, stark shadows carved my face into a more fierce countenance than I actually possessed. But it wasn't just the light. This was not the face of the fry cook I had been, not the face of the boy who had walked hand in hand with Stormy into an arcade to pose an important question to Gypsy Mummy. I found my eyes distressing. I turned from the mirror. I'd not seen any of my current adversaries' faces, except for that of Wolfgang on his driver's license. In mirrors, did they see the wickedness behind their masks? And was there a point past which they avoided mirrors? I thought I would leave by the door, but it could be neither locked nor unlocked from inside. When I climbed out of the window, flashlight in hand, the first thing that caught my attention was my Explorer out along the road, beyond the gate, illuminated by the headlights of the SUV that was now parked behind it. A white Mercedes SUV, like the one that had cruised slowly by while I had hidden behind the ficus natida. The vehicle that I had assured myself was driven by an elderly couple coming home from a church supper. If there had been retirees in it back then, they must have been carjacked in the meantime. Two men, neither of them elderly, were looking over the Explorer, clearly visible even at 30 yards because the headlights of the vehicle revealed them. Reverse psychic magnetism. Jim and Bob. I'd thought too intently about them, had sought them too insistently. Because I didn't have faces to go with their names, not even a distinctive voice for either one, I had been unable to find them. But they had been drawn, and here they were. One of them happened to be looking toward me. When I came out of the shattered window, he pointed, and at once the second man turned his attention to me as well. The security lamps over the comfort station entrances betrayed me, as did the feeble beam of my small flashlight, but that wasn't why I had caught their attention. They could not have missed me, for I was to them what a magnet is to iron filings. 26. I could run from them, but to what end? I needed the Explorer. The chief had been right when he said that things were moving fast. Whatever catastrophe might make Pico Mundo the biggest story of the year, it would unfold within the next several hours, surely before dawn. If I had any hope of discovering what the cult intended and putting a stop to it, I had to be mobile. I couldn't chase down the truth on foot or by hoping to thumb a ride every time I needed one. If I had an advantage, it was that people who were drawn to me by reverse psychic magnetism were not aware of what had brought them into my presence. They felt no compulsion to find me, no attracting power. They made excuses to themselves for why they deviated from their plans and set off to places that they had no intention of visiting. Maybe they told themselves that they needed time to think about what they intended to do next. Maybe they convinced themselves that just cruising around would free their minds to consider their options more clearly. Whatever the case, they were always surprised to see me. Without hesitation, I started toward the gate at the entrance, as if I had no concern about these men's intentions, as if I assumed that people who drove Mercedes SUVs were all upstanding citizens who wanted only the best for their fellow men, an end to all hunger and world peace. They probably didn't even know who I was. They hadn't seen me with the Explorer when they'd cruised past it in town. Here the Ford was again, yes, and they would be puzzled as to why they'd been interested in it earlier, and why they should stumble upon it now when they were just cruising around at random, miles from where it had been parked before. Whether they had tumbled to my identity or not, they would know me when I drew closer to them. The cult had been searching for me, and they surely had old newspaper photographs to go by, if nothing else. By the time I reached the fence, they would recognize me, and they would for a moment be surprised. A moment. 3 seconds, 4. For another moment, they would wonder what I was doing out there at that hour, if I knew about the nearby dam and the C4, and if I might have told anyone what I knew. 2 seconds, 3. For another moment, they would look at each other, consulting on a course of action, with or without words. They would want to kill me, yes, but they might also want to capture me, so that they could first torture me into revealing anything I knew about Edie Fisher and her organization, which was as secret as theirs and opposed to them at every turn. 4 seconds, 5. Those 3 moments gave me a fearfully narrow path to survival. In fact, it wasn't even a path, but a tightrope, a high wire across which I had to run, not walk. I pretended no suspicion, calling out, "Hello!" as I approached them through the darkness. Pretending the kind of inebriation that can be detected not so much by the drunk's slurred words as by his too loud and too hearty speech, pretending also that I assumed that they were park employees, I said, "Needed a damn toilet! Why'd you lock up? God's sake! Had to bust out a window 'cause you locked it up!" I couldn't shoot at them through a chain-link fence with any hope of scoring a hit. I had to climb it before they drew on me. As I came out of the darkness into the backwash of their SUV's headlights, I faked a stumble and cursed and ducked my head to hide my face. I believe I started climbing the chain link before they realized who I was. I reached the top by the time they were getting to the end of the second of those 3 moments. Instead of coming down the other side of the gate, I froze at the top, drew the Glock from my shoulder rig, thought for an instant it was going to snag on the powder blue sport coat, and as they went for their weapons too late, I fired down on them. The first round took one of them in the gut, and he began to scream, his gun slipping out of his grip even as he drew it. The second round took the other man point-blank in the face, blowing out the back of his skull, and he was no doubt dead before he hit the ground. The belly-shot man lay on his back, clutching his abdomen with both hands, so racked by pain that he squirmed like a broken bug. The terror and agony that twisted his face were ghastly, and yet, when I approached him, he begged for his life, which would be for him only mere terror and greater agony. Instead of granting his plea, I shot him twice again, and he fell silent. A voice behind me said, "Murderer." When I pivoted to confront the new threat, no one was there but the dead man whom I'd shot in the face. I waited, but if he had spoken, he did not speak again. Although rock steady to that point, I began to tremble so badly that I feared accidentally firing another round, and I holstered the pistol. I shook as if with palsy, and I didn't know what to do with my hands, whether to put them in my pockets or smooth back my hair with them or tuck them into my armpits to press the tremors out of them. And so I stood there, making meaningless gestures, gagging on each breath I tried to take. In the cause of saving children and other innocents, I'd killed before. I had even shot women, 3 of them, 2 who tried to shoot me, and 1 who would have cut me to ribbons given half a chance. Killing was never easy. Regardless of the viciousness and palpable evil of the target, killing was never easy. But this time the necessity had shaken and distressed me more violently than ever. These men didn't deserve the slightest measure of pity. They had ruthlessly executed Wolfgang, Jonathan, and Celine. They surely had killed many others, perhaps including some of the children that the cult was so fond of sacrificing on their blood-stained altars. Their particular deaths were not what rocked me so profoundly. I was shaken instead by the cumulative killing that I'd done, as if I'd committed the act often enough that, here tonight, I crossed some moral boundary beyond which I would be forever changed, some boundary that I could not retreat behind and find again the person I'd once been. No matter what I'd become, I could not say, enough of this, could not walk away from the fight. That choice was forbidden to me, as it had been most of my life. Something big and bad would happen to Pico Mundo if the cult wasn't stopped. My horror, guilt, and sorrow mattered not at all when compared to the deaths of thousands that I'd foreseen. This task would not be lifted from me, and to refuse it would be to refuse the desired destiny that I'd been promised. Stormy. I had to get out of there before someone drove by and saw the carnage. Because of the threat to the dam, a patrol car might cruise along that lonely road, in which case my friendship with Wyatt Porter and even my unwanted reputation as a hero would not guarantee me the freedom of movement that I must have for the rest of the night. First, I needed their wallets. No, I didn't need them, I wanted them. Not for the money, to prove something to myself. I stepped carefully, grateful for the Mercedes headlights, loath to step on a fragment of skull bone, a twist of hair and flesh, a spattering of brains. Behind the wheel of the Explorer, I searched the pockets of my jeans for the keys, then my jacket pockets, panicking, wondering if I'd dropped them somewhere between there and the public restrooms in the park. In the last pocket, my fingers closed on the coiled plastic ring, and then on the key itself. I hung a U-turn and drove west. A mile from the park entrance, I pulled to a stop on the shoulder of the road. The two billfolds I had taken lay on the passenger seat. My hands still trembled as I went through one wallet and then the other, searching for ID. This is a world where tragic mistakes are common. The white Mercedes SUV might not have been the same one that I'd seen earlier. Perhaps the men whom I'd shot would prove to be not who I thought they were. I'd killed them without hearing a word of what they had to say, without asking a question of them. They'd pulled their guns only after I'd drawn mine. Maybe they had licenses to carry concealed weapons, which I did not. Maybe they were authorities of some kind, with legitimate reasons to ask me what I'd been doing in the park when it was closed for the night. Both men possessed current Nevada driver's licenses. James Morton Sterling. Robert Foster Cokeberry. Jim and Bob. My relief wasn't as complete as I might have anticipated. They were indeed the men I suspected they were, but if I'd not made a tragic mistake back at the park gate, I might well make one the next time. Headlights appeared in the distance, and a vehicle approached from the west. I drove onto the state route once more, and a moment later a Dodge pickup swept past me in the eastbound lane. In a minute or so, the dead men would be found. In California, hardened criminals were often turned loose after serving a mere fraction of their sentences, because prison overcrowding was considered cruel and unusual punishment. But if you drove while talking on a handheld phone, you'd be shown no mercy. I risked the pitiless brute force of the law by calling Chief Porter without pulling off the highway. "Sir, you're going to get a call soon about a white Mercedes SUV and two dead men at the gate to Malo Suerte Park."
"It's not been a half an hour since we last talked."
"Yes, sir. I've got a wristwatch. Their names are James Morton Sterling and Robert Foster Cokeberry."
"Jim and Bob."
"The two and only."
"Let me get a pen." "There. Okay. Repeat their names."
I repeated them. "They both have Nevada driver's licenses."
"Are you okay, Adi?"
"Yeah, sure. I'm okay."
"Because you don't sound okay."
"Not a scratch," I assured him. After a silence, because he knew me well, he said,
"Not all wounds are the bleeding kind."
I didn't want to talk about it. "I've got their driver's licenses, Chief. I'm going to the dam now, so I'll leave them with Sonny and Billy."
"By the way, I talked to Mr. Donatella."
"Who?"
"Lou Donatella, you know, in the bear suit. Though he wasn't wearing it by the time I got to him. He and Ollie were drinking coffee, eating brown sugar pavlovas. They're delicious. Have you ever had one?"
"No, sir. I don't even know what a pavlova is."
They're delicious is what they are. Lou made them himself. He's a nice little guy. He gave me some useful stuff about this Wolfgang Schmidt. Ahead on the left loomed a sign rimmed with pentagons of highly reflective plastic. Malo Suerte Dam. Schmidt claimed to come from a carny family when he bought one of the concessionaires, but Lou said the guy was no more a carny than Mozart was a carny. Lou's into classical music. I'm turning onto the service road to the dam, sir. I'll call you back in a little while. What do you expect to find there, son? I don't know. I'm just drawn to it. You sure you're all right?
I'm fine.
Call me when you get a chance. I'll be here. This is looking like an all-nighter.
No, sir. My hunch is this thing's gonna blow before midnight.
Let's hope you're right, he said.
I thought, let's hope I'm wrong. 27. The service road led through land so parched that you wouldn't expect to find a dam and a large body of water at the end of it. To both sides, my headlight showed bare earth, scatterings of stones, an occasional bristle of nameless weeds, no mesquite, no cactus. Far to the south, along the horizon, heat lightning pulsed through the clouds, smooth, radiant waves rather than jagged spears. 40 or 50 miles away, perhaps a downpour washed the desert. Rain didn't always travel as far as heat lightning could be seen, and Pico Mundo might not receive a drop all night. The breast of the dam didn't in scale match that engineering wonder Boulder Dam over in Nevada. Pico Mundians prided themselves on being the smallest town of 40,000 anywhere in the world. That slogan, created by the Chamber of Commerce, meant to convey to tourists that we were big enough to offer a wide range of activities and accommodations, and that, nevertheless, we remained simple people with homespun wisdom, down-home manners, and a tradition of welcoming strangers as we would our own kin. You could go to Boulder, Nevada, and do your boating on Lake Mead, behind the ostentatiously massive breastworks of their dam, if you didn't mind the greedy casinos, all owned by humongous corporations, luring you to nearby Vegas, trying every minute of the day to get their hands in your pockets. Or you could come to Pico Mundo and enjoy boating on Malo Suerte Lake, behind a dam that was practical and human in scale. Nothing like that Hitlerian structure across the border. Only 102 feet across and 38 feet from crest to sill. Our dam had no hydroelectric powerhouse because it had been constructed with the modest intention of creating a pristine lake for recreational use and, in times of drought, a lake that could also serve as a source of water for a few major Maravilla County reservoirs downstream from it. There were sluice gates toward the north end of the dam and a squat concrete outlet control structure about 20 feet square. The building looked like a miniature fortress, with a crenellated parapet around its flat roof and windows hardly larger than arrow loops. When I braked to a stop at the end of the service road, Sonny Wexler and Billy Monday were standing by their squad car. One of them held a shotgun. The other had what might have been a fully automatic carbine, like maybe an Uzi, which indicated the seriousness with which they took the threat. They must have had a way to operate the headlights remotely, because as I approached, the high beams from their black and white nearly blinded me. The officers eased behind the squad car, one near the rear, the other at the front, using it as cover, leveling their weapons, as if they thought Dr. Evil had just arrived on the first step of a crusade for world domination. I switched off my headlights, put down the side window, and leaned my head out so they could see who had come calling. They knew I was close with the chief. In fact, after the business at Green Moon Mall a couple of years earlier, they were among the officers who had insisted that I be given a citation for bravery, which was now packed away with Stormy's belongings in a room in Ozzie Boone's house. Shotgun at the ready, Sonny Wexler, big and tough and as soft-spoken as a monk, with forearms as thick as a sumo wrestler's calves, cautiously approached the explorer. He stayed wide of it, so that Billy could have a clear shot if someone in addition to me came out of the vehicle.
You alone in there, Odd?
Haunted by the shootings at the park, I worried that my voice or a reoccurrence of the shakes would give them reason to wonder about me. But when I spoke, I sounded normal, which may not speak well of me.
Yes, sir, I am. I'm alone.
The chief said you were back.
Good, because I am. I'm back.
It's good to have you back,
he said, but he didn't lower the shotgun.
It's good to be back, I assured him.
You know what's happening?
I do, sir. I put the chief onto it.
Why don't you get out, Sonny said, and walk around your vehicle. Open all the doors in the tailgate so I can see straight through.
All right, sir.
I got out of the driver's door.
It's not that I don't trust you, Odd.
I understand, sir.
I trust you like a brother.
That's good to hear, sir.
It's just you might have come here under duress.
No problem, I said, opening the back door on the driver's side.
It's not every night of the week somebody wants to blow up the dam.
I said, boring old Pico Mundo, as I raised the tailgate.
After I opened all the doors, and after Sonny circled the Ford, looking straight through it from every angle, I closed up what I'd opened. Tension reduced, the three of us gathered by the back of their cruiser as they remoted the headlights off. Billy Monday wasn't a titan like Sonny Wexler, but he had a few inches and 30 pounds of muscle on me. Standing with them, I felt like Lou the Bear with two ollies. The lights were on for the length of the single-lane road that crossed the crest of the dam, and a series of spotlights lit the breast from the top. It really looked pathetic compared to Boulder Dam. More heat lightning throbbed through the clouds far to the south, too far away for the trailing thunder to reach us, and for some reason the sight of it made me shudder.
You hear about the C-4?
Sonny asked.
Yeah.
That's major wicked stuff. Ruinous. Who would want to do this?
People who know Burn Eccles. That surprised them. They'd been on the force with him, and he was an embarrassment to them. Billy said,
Eccles, that son of a bitch, he's away for life.
You could say these people go to the same church. Sonny shook his head.
Wackos. The world is full of wackos these days. All these wackos, it's not going to end well.
Nothing like this ever happens with Baptists, Billy said.
Or even with Presbyterians,
Sonny said.
What can we do for you, Odd? What brought you all the way out here?
That was an excellent question. I wished I had an answer. The chief just asked if I'd come to the dam and, you know, sort of have a look around, you know, maybe walk across the service road there on the crest. Just in general kind of see whatever there is to see, if there's anything at all, which probably there isn't, but it won't hurt to give it a try. I sounded so lame, rambling toward incoherence, that I wouldn't have been surprised if they wanted to test my blood alcohol level. Maybe the only good thing about people thinking you were a hero once, long ago, is that they treat you seriously, no matter how idiotic you might sound. Sonny and Billy nodded solemnly as I babbled, hearing more sense in my speech than I put into it.
Sure, Sonny Wexler said. That's a good idea. Go on out there and have a look.
Fresh eyes, Billy Monday said. Always a good idea to get fresh eyes on a problem.
There were some prairie wolves around when we got here, Sonny said. Bolder than usual. Give us a holler if they bother you.
Some people in Merivia County referred to them as prairie wolves, but most just called them coyotes.
Yes, sir, I'll keep a lookout, I said. But a coyote pack doesn't worry me half as much as the lunatics who stole the C-4.
What we've been waiting to hear, Sonny said, is an incoming plane.
Billy said, if they load the C-4 in a plane and time it just right so it detonates as they crash the plane into the breast of the dam, there isn't a thing we could do to stop them.
If you hear a plane, Sonny advised me, best do what we'll do, which is run like hell.
I wouldn't have thought of a plane, I said.
And Billy nodded. We wish we hadn't. 28. Entering from the north, I walked more than halfway across the crest of the dam before I leaned against the guardrail and looked down the lighted spillway that sloped to the plunge pool. In a planned outflow, water would collect in the pool before brimming over the sill into the stilling basin, and in controlled volume it would pour from there into the dry riverbed. I didn't see anything suspicious, but of course I didn't know whether the scene before me was as it should be. I had no idea what I was looking for. Often it seemed to me that my psychic gifts ought to have been bestowed upon someone with a higher IQ than mine. On the lake side of the road, the regularly spaced lamps built into the guardrail cast some light upon the water that lapped gently at the Tainter Gates. But only 10 or 15 feet out, the lake went black, an inky immensity in this moonless, starless night. In certain old movies set in World War II, Navy frogmen would approach a target underwater, bridge supports, ships in harbor, and surface just long enough to plant explosives. I didn't know how many well-trained scuba divers would be required to attach more than a ton of C4 to the dam, though probably at least 50, each of them burdened with 40 pounds of the stuff, schooling like fish. No, impractical. A boat was more likely than frogmen. Anyone guarding the dam would hear the boat coming, especially in this quiet. But they most likely wouldn't be able to stop it in time, not just by hoping to pick off the pilot with sniper fire. If the boat had an electric motor, it could approach silently, raising no alarm. Sonny and Billy hadn't mentioned an attack from the water, but if they'd considered an airplane loaded with C4, they must have thought of a boat. When I turned from the lake, I saw movement past the south end of the dam, beyond the last lights, a lesser darkness in the deeper dark. Squinting brought no further clarity, only the same impression of restless motion. Reaching beneath my sport coat, keeping one hand on the Glock in its holster, I walked south to have a closer look. When I was about 20 feet from the end of the dam, the visitor's shining eyes turned on me. Three pairs, mirroring the crest lamps, intently staring. As I came to a halt, they ventured a few steps out of the shadows. During the past 21 months, coyotes had been a recurring presence in my life, beginning on the night before Stormy's death, when three of them had stalked me outside a rusting Quonset hut on the abandoned grounds of a commune, where once had lived people who believed that extraterrestrials had created human beings and that the ETs would soon return. Just 4 months before I found myself on the crest of the Malo Suerte Dam, I'd been through hard and desperate times in Magic Beach, California, during which I'd been threatened by coyotes in packs. On one such occasion, Anna Marie had been with me, walking the wild rim of Hecate's Canyon in Magic Beach, when a pack approached with such an obvious intention to make dinner of us that they should have been wearing bibs. Usually coyotes fear humans and keep their distance from us. A loud noise will frighten them off, as will a tossed stone that doesn't even hit them. But the pack that came out of Hecate's Canyon had exhibited no fear whatsoever. I'd had no gun that night, because I'd loathed guns then, as I did now. And we were on a greensward, where I couldn't find any of the impromptu weapons to which I often resorted. Buckets, brooms, garden rakes, Granny Smith apples. Cats that, when thrown, will reliably take out their fury not on the thrower, but instead on the person at whom they're thrown. I didn't like throwing cats or animals of any kind, as far as that goes, but every once in a while, in a life-and-death situation, there's nothing to be done but grab a cat and throw it, or an angry ferret. Anyway, as it turned out, I wasn't without a weapon after all, because Anna Maria proved to be a weapon herself. She had said that the coyotes were not only what they appeared to be, and she'd stepped toward them instead of cowering, unfazed by their threatening demeanor. She spoke to them not as if they were bloodthirsty beasts, but rather as if they were naughty children who'd gone astray and needed to be put on the right path again. Now, months later, as the lantern-eyed pack crept onto the crest of the Malo Suerte Dam, daring to stalk me, I didn't want to shoot them. I didn't want to shout for help from Sonny and Billy, who were beyond the outlet control building and not in my line of sight, because I didn't want the coyotes to be shot by anyone. I'd had enough of killing to last me a lifetime. I might have to do it again, maybe more than once, but I didn't have to do it here and now. Ears flattened close to their skulls, teeth bared, hackles raised, tails tucked, they tentatively approached me, every muscle in their lean bodies taut. They were bony specimens, in need of a good meal, but it would be a mistake to conclude that they were weak. Were I not to use my pistol, just one coyote would be enough to finish me if it could not be frightened away. I spoke to them as Anna Maria had spoken to the toothy crew on the greensward near Hecate's Canyon. You aren't only what you appear to be. You do not belong here. The leader of the pack halted, and the other two drew nearer to it, closing up what had been a three-prong attack pattern. Their pointy ears were no longer back against their heads, but were instead pricked, as though they were interested in what I said. Their mouths cracked wider, however, and they regarded me with malevolent grins. Again echoing Anna Maria's admonition to that other pack, I said, "The rest of the world is yours, but not this place at this moment." Back in the day, I hadn't understood what she'd meant by those words. Now I thought perhaps I did. Far to the south, pulses of heat lightning billowed deep within the heavy clouds, again too distant for the associated thunder to reach us. Although their backs were to the southern sky, and though the celestial flare was too faint to cast even a wan reflection upon our immediate surroundings, the three coyotes shivered, as if aware of the storm light and affected by it. "I am not yours. You will leave now." They didn't depart, didn't move so much as an inch, but neither did they growl. The coyotes in Magic Beach had not at once obeyed Anna Maria. They'd been stubborn, or maybe whatever wish to use them had been stubborn. And so I repeated, "You will leave now." The predatory trio looked around as though confused, as though unsure how they had gotten where they were. Their hackles smoothed, and although they nervously licked their chops, they no longer bared their fearsome teeth. Ears pricked, regarding me not with hostility or hunger, only with curiosity. They warily backed away. "Leave now," I repeated. They turned and slunk off the crest of the dam toward the darkness out of which they had appeared. When they paused in the pale light of the narrow shadowland that separated the brightness of the dam crest from the blackest night, I watched them watching me, and I knew they were now only what they appeared to be, coyotes or prairie wolves, whichever you preferred. Briefly, some vicious, twisted spirit had entered them and had overridden their fear of me. But for all its malice, it was a weak entity that obeyed a simple order to leave once its presence had been recognized and resisted. The coyotes moved away into the blinding dark, gone as if they'd never existed. I felt again the mysterious nature of the world, its deeply layered and profound strangeness. I wondered at my inability, until now, to understand what Anna Maria had recognized in the coyotes in Magic Beach, and why she had felt that she could command them to leave us alone. Considering that I saw the spirits of the lingering dead in Bodox, whatever they might be, it troubled me that I'd not realized she could perhaps see other entities unknown to me, such as spirits who were not or never had been human, that sprang from origins even darker than the worst specimens of humanity. I'd long known Anna Maria possessed some power of her own, that she had well-guarded secrets. She, too, was more than she appeared to be. I'd come to believe that her powers, whatever their nature, were greater than mine. But now I was chagrined to realize that I had failed to grasp how we were at least in one way alike. Some things visible to us were invisible to the vast majority of human beings, even if perhaps each of us saw different things from what the other perceived. At the railing once more, I peered toward the farther reaches of Malo Suerte Lake, which were cast in such perfect blackness that I couldn't discern either those waters or anything of the shore that embraced them. When I turned my attention down to the water lapping against the dam, I couldn't see it either. Not really see it, for it was black as well, and I could know that it slopped against the Tainter gates below me, only because reflections of the crest lights undulated upon its surface. Standing there, I was overcome by the certainty that, since returning home to Pico Mundo, I had failed to see much more than just the malicious entity that had sought to use the three coyotes against me. A monstrous act of terrorism would soon be perpetrated. The truth of it, the approximate place and the general nature of the threat, had been revealed to me in a prophetic dream. Or if they had not been fully revealed, they had at least been strongly suggested. Yes, I could see what others could not, but seeing wasn't the same as understanding. I'd been given perceptions that Sherlock Holmes would have envied, but I didn't have Sherlockian wit to make the most of what I saw. With fewer clues than I possessed, Holmes routinely puzzled his way to the mystery's solution with little or no violence. In spite of my hatred of violence, I more often than not had to bludgeon and shoot my way to a resolution. When last Pico Mundo was threatened, I'd put the pieces together a few minutes too late, saving some potential victims, but not 19, and not her. I looked at my wristwatch, 9 o'clock. Not only minutes were slipping through my fingers, but also the lives of those I might fail to save. When I returned from the dam, Sonny Wexler said, "Anything?" "You must have thought of a boat, sir. An electric boat?" Billy Munday shook his head. "It couldn't get close enough. 100 yards out from the dam, there's a loose woven net of steel cables shore to shore. Starts about 2 feet above the high water line and goes almost all the way to the bottom."
"1-inch diameter cable," Sonny added. "You need acetylene torches and a few hours to get through it, and either night or day, you draw a lot of attention to yourself."
"The net's to keep recreational boats and jet skis from getting too near the dam," Billy explained. "If a swimmer was in the water and the Tainter gates were opened, he might be pulled in and over the spillway, or dragged under by a current and drowned."
"Can the net be raised and lowered mechanically?" I asked.
"Sure, from the outlet control building, but no one's getting in there as long as we're guarding the place."
Sonny Wexler said,
"And the chief's sending backup. 2 more guys will be here soon."
I knew why Chief Porter made that decision, and I was reminded of Jim and Bob's driver's licenses.
I fished the plastic rectangles from a jacket pocket and handed them to Sonny. "I told the chief I'd give you these. They're conspirators in all this, very bad guys." As he and his partner examined the licenses, Billy Munday said, "Memorable faces. We'll know them if we see them."
"You won't be seeing them," I said. "Those are just for you to give to the chief." Sonny frowned.
"We won't be seeing them. How'd you get their licenses anyway?"
I said only, "The chief knows all about it, sir."
Their stares were of the kind that make the most law-abiding citizens feel as if there's a crime to which they should confess. I didn't look away from them. Met the eyes of one, and then the eyes of the other. They didn't look away from me, either. Peripherally, I was aware of the heat lightning to the south, as if an alien spaceship or a colossal creature of light passed through the shrouding clouds along the horizon. But the storm wasn't here, wasn't now. At last, Sonny tucked the licenses in the breast pocket of his uniform shirt.
"I thought you came home just to come home, but I guess there's more to it than that."
"Well, sir, I'm sure glad to be home. It's where I belong. But there's always more to everything than there seems to be."
"That's as true as it gets," said Billy Munday.
Sonny put one of his enormous hands on my shoulder.
"You be careful out there, Odd."
"Yes, sir. I want to be."
I drove the Explorer all the way along the service road to the state highway before the connection occurred to me. It wasn't one I wanted to make, but I knew immediately that it was right. For the time during which they had stalked me, the coyotes at the dam had been more than they appeared to be. Some dark spirit had taken possession of them.
earlier in the day, shortly after dawn, when I'd encountered the coyote on the street where I'd parked the big dog motorcycle, it must have been more than it appeared to be as well. And at the safe house, when I'd come downstairs to the kitchen for dinner, Deacon Bullock had at that moment entered through the back door, carrying a shotgun. His wife Mabel had said to him, "Seeing as you're alive, must have been a false alarm like you thought." "Dang coyote," Deke had said. "Slinking around, maybe hoping for one of them chickens we don't even raise, set off a motion detector." Indicating the sunlight at the windows, she had said, "Early for one of their kind being on the hunt." "It was a bonier specimen than usual," he'd replied. "Maybe too hungry to wait out the sun." That coyote, like the others in my day, must have been more than it appeared to be. The four who had been the only members of the cult that shot up Green Moon Mall, Eccles, Varner, Gossett, Robertson, had been pretend Satanists, men with a taste for murder, cruel sadists who dressed up their barbarism with occult nonsense that had nothing to do with real devil worship. As I'd told Chief Porter earlier in the day, the cult that had owned the isolated estate in Nevada was serious about its Satanism. It had been established in England in 1580, and among its founding members had been clergymen and nobility. Over the generations, the cultists accumulated enormous wealth, which bought them political influence, but not only wealth. During the centuries, they also acquired genuine supernatural power. Not so much that they could stop me from rescuing the kidnapped children and bringing about the destruction of that estate, but power nonetheless. I'd spied upon a ceremony for which they conjured demonic entities to witness their human sacrifices. Using animals as their remote eyes and ears might be well within their abilities. The coyote that had triggered the motion detectors outside the safe house might have been a proxy for the cultists, a proxy through which the property's perimeter alarm system could be explored and its weak points discovered. I phoned the number that Mr. Bullock had asked me to memorize. He'd said that he would be available whenever I called, even after midnight. Following four rings, I was sent to voicemail. Dreading that I had called too late, I left a brief message. "This is me. This is Odd Thomas. Get out of the house. Get out now." 29. Driving back to town, I repeatedly checked my rearview mirror. Apparently I had no tail. I didn't drive directly to the safe house or cruise past it. I concluded that would be suicide. I wasn't ready to die, not until I had stopped, or at least done my best to stop, whatever catastrophe might be planned for Pico Mundo. I knew my hometown well, even here in its rural outskirts. In an area of horse farms and ranchettes and undeveloped land, I pulled off the two-lane blacktop and parked among a stand of cottonwoods, far enough from the road that the headlights of the passing vehicles wouldn't reveal the explorer. After switching off the engine, I called Deke Bullock again, and as before, he didn't answer, which most likely meant he was dead. Maybelle Bullock had probably been killed too. Perhaps the safe house had been discovered and invaded, its caretakers murdered, because of the astronaut who'd seen something shocking in space and had been running for his life ever since, or because of some other hapless fugitive who had been given shelter there for a while. Maybe. But I was convinced that the responsibility lay with me, that unknowingly I'd led someone to it when I arrived that morning on the big dog bike. Maybelle had made my favorite peach pie. She'd hugged me and kissed my cheek before I'd left. She and Deacon had been so sweet together, bantering about whether they'd endured 5 or instead 6 bad days and 28 years of marriage. My anger might serve me well in the hours ahead, but it came with a gray despair that I had to resist. If the Bullocks were dead, there could be no good reason for me to return to the house, and no wisdom in doing so. If my only purpose was to confirm their deaths, I would most likely ensure my own. Supposing they were not dead, however, I had an obligation to assist them. Perhaps they were under siege and needed reinforcements. Or one of them, wounded and left for dead, might still be saved. Our world was a battleground on which good and evil clashed, and many of the combatants on the dark side were known to everyone. Terrorists, dictators, politicians who were the merchants of lies and hate, crooked businessmen in league with them, power-mad bureaucrats, corrupted policemen, embezzlers, street thugs, rapists and their ilk, waged part of the war, and their actions were what made the evening news so colorful and depressing. But those fighting in that dark army had their secret schemes, too. Intentions and desires and goals that would make their public villainy seem almost innocent by comparison. They were assisted by other politicians who concealed their hatred and envy, by judges who secretly had no respect for the law, by clergymen who in private worshipped nothing but money or the tender bodies of children, by celebrities who trumpeted their concern for the common man while in their off-screen lives, assiduously hobnobbing with and advancing the interests of the elite of elites. The war unseen by most people was one of clandestine militias, unincorporated businesses, uncharted organizations, philosophical movements that could not survive fresh air and sunlight, secretive coalitions of lunatics who didn't recognize their own lunacy, nature cults and science cults and religious cults. And, as I knew too well, there was supernatural evil participating in this secret war against order, good, and innocence. However, the supernatural was only one regiment of that army, and, you might be surprised to hear, numbered far fewer troops than the flesh-and-blood human beings who fought in the countless other battalions. Until I had met Mrs. Edie Fisher 2 months earlier, on the Pacific Coast Highway, when she'd come cruising along in a humongous limousine, I hadn't realized that my side in this secret war had its own clandestine militias and uncharted organizations determined to defeat all the aforementioned malevolent individuals and forces. I now had companions at arms, like Mr. and Mrs. Bullock, with resources to match those of the enemy. On our side of this war, one didn't leave a friend unsupported. You never, never left a friend to die alone. I walked out of the grove of cottonwoods and crossed the quiet country lane, marveling at how ordinary the night seemed, as every night and day seemed if you saw only the surface of things. I climbed a split-rail fence into a pasture where, during the day, horses grazed on sweet grass. Remaining properly oriented in a night so deeply overcast, with nothing to illuminate my way except the glow of downtown Pico Mundo reflected dimly off the low clouds, I would have stumbled or fallen or stepped in a pile of horse product more than once, if not for my psychic magnetism. Focusing on a mental image of the Victorian house at the end of the driveway that led between colonnades of velvet ashes, I followed the fence to the corner, turned right, and followed it farther before my sixth sense told me to climb it again and to cross a graveled lane into an unfenced field. I stayed away from stables and outbuildings and avoided the occasional house with lighted windows. In 10 minutes, I came to the ground behind the stable that had been converted into the long garage where my big dog bulldog Bagger awaited deconstruction. I drew the Glock from my shoulder rig and crept along the back wall of the garage to a corner from which I could see the safe house. Lamplight, none of it very bright, filtered by curtains and draperies, shone at some windows, and others were dark. The back door stood open, which I interpreted as meaning either that Mr. and Mrs. Bullock had fled an assault, or that the assassins had done their dirty work and gone away. I considered both those possibilities, but my usually reliable intuition wouldn't endorse either of them. Although I stood listening for a minute or two, I heard nothing that warned me off. The night was so quiet that it almost seemed to be already submerged under fathoms of water. I left the cover of the garage and crossed the yard. Warily, I climbed 4 brick steps to the back porch. When we'd sat down for dinner, the kitchen windows had been opened to the late spring light. Now they were covered by blinds. Surprisingly, the porch floor didn't creak underfoot. Although it appeared to be painted wood, it felt as solid as concrete. At the open door, I hesitated, but then went inside quick and low with a Glock in a two-hand grip. A light above the sink and another under the cooktop hood kept darkness at bay, but the kitchen was large, and shadows draped a few corners. Rounding the dinette table, I almost stepped into a pool of some liquid that was difficult to see on the dark floor. Judging by the more obvious scarlet spatters on the nearby doors of the glossy white cabinetry, the pool must be blood. 30. The pantry door stood open on darkness. I assumed that if anyone had been waiting in there, he would have already shot me. The swinging door between the kitchen and the downstairs hallway was blocked half open by a large, dead man. Not Deacon Bullock. Lying face down across the threshold, dressed in black sneakers, black jeans, and a long-sleeved black T-shirt. Ordinarily, I wouldn't describe what a dead man was wearing any more than I would describe the design on a $10 bill that I used to buy a burger and fries. But in this case, the hombre's outfit was important because he was clearly dressed like an assassin. And then there were the ski mask and the latex gloves. Professional killers, sent to clean out one of their enemy's safe houses, would expect resistance. This guy wouldn't have come alone to do such dangerous work, and in fact his team probably would have numbered 3 or 4. Two interior doors led out of the kitchen, and the second opened into the dining room. To avoid the dead man and the soup of bodily fluids in which he sprawled, I preferred to stay out of the bright hallway. I eased open the swinging door to a dining room that was dimly revealed by the crystal chandelier hanging in the center of that space. The fixture had been adjusted to a low setting, and in the faint light the table appeared to be intended not for serving a meal, but for conducting a séance. Earlier during my stay in this house, I hadn't noticed the uncanny silence with which doors moved on hinges and with which the floors received each footstep. For all the noise I made, I might as well have been a ghost. A half-open door on the left led to the hallway. Another at the far end connected to the parlor, which I knew because Deacon Bullock had brought me this way from the kitchen when he had first taken me upstairs to see my room. Another sizable dead man lay across the threshold between the dining room and the parlor. He and the first stiff were dressed alike in every detail. He hadn't purged bowels and bladder in his death throes, as had the other guy, but he still lay in a bit of a mess. His head was turned sideways. Through one of the holes in the ski mask, a fixed eye stared into another world. Just beyond his reaching hand on the floor of the next room lay a pistol fitted with a sound suppressor. I'd seen so few of these people's faces that I was tempted to pull off the dead man's ski mask. I resisted the urge when I thought irrationally, what will you do if the face is yours? I didn't want to step in blood or on a corpse, but the latter was unavoidable because of the dead man's size and the limitations of my stride. The heel of my right shoe came down on the fingers of his right hand. Fortunately, the contact produced little sound, the faintest squeak of the latex gloves stretching under my shoe, and I didn't stumble. Although I almost revealed my presence by saying, "Sorry, sir." Doorways were the worst. When you're on a hunt, you must clear them properly, low and fast, weapon in a two-hand grip, tracking the muzzle left to right or right to left, depending on the situation, seeking a target. Even fry cooks know that. The two men who had stopped bullets were dressed and armed like professionals who were trained and experienced in making such transitions, and yet they were dead in doorways. The parlor was poorly lighted by a single lamp with a pleated blue silk shade and crowded with heavy Victorian furniture, a pair of Chesterfields wingback armchairs, things to crouch behind for concealment. No one popped out of hiding to blast away at me, though the metronomic tock, tock, tock of the pendulum in the grandfather clock seemed to be counting off my last seconds. As in the dining room, the draperies had been drawn shut at all the windows, perhaps to prevent anyone outside from determining the location of the residence. A wide archway, instead of a door, connected the parlor to the foyer. I found it refreshing to see that no one lay dead on that threshold. the foyer. Deserted. To the right, the front door was closed. To the left of the archway lay the brightly lighted hall. Opposite the dining room and parlor were three other rooms that I hadn't explored. My sense of things was that the action had moved on from the ground floor after the first two men had been shot. I regarded the stairs, hesitating to climb them and leave unsearched rooms behind me. Overhead, someone said, "Huck," as though violently clearing his throat, and immediately thereafter something thudded to the floor in an upstairs room. If, as I had every reason to expect, a third dead man had just given up his ghost, the thud wasn't as loud as it ought to have been. The floors allowed me to walk as quietly as a cat, and they soaked up most of the sound of dead men falling, which suggested that silence favored the bullocks, and that the place had been constructed as both a safe house and a trap. Cautioning myself that a trap can sometimes spring unexpectedly and catch not the prey, but instead the one who set it, I went to the stairs and climbed warily, silently. I glanced back now and then, prepared to discover that I was looking down the barrel of a gun, but I remained alone. 31. At the top of the stairs, I looked along a hallway with large paintings on the walls between doorways, of which there were four on each side. No dead guys were tumbled across any of the thresholds. The first door on the left stood half open, and a lamp glowed in there, but I couldn't see the entire space, just the foot of a bed and a dresser and a small armchair in a corner. I cleared the doorway and discovered the room unoccupied. There were an attached bath and a closet, but I didn't want to investigate them. A hit team didn't enter a house to hide in closets and behind bathroom doors. An assault required speed and continuous movement, even if,